birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good.
Welcome to the third podcast for Blues Dance World. My name is Hafsa, and I'm one of your hosts for tonight.
I'm Carl from San Diego.
I'm Elena from Seattle.
Andy from L.A.
And we are so very excited to have Dave Madison as our third guest. Dave?
I'm Dave Madison, and I'm from lots of places. my from
Where
status
are you currently?
On Facebook is it's complicated.
Nice. That's
awesome. Currently, I'm in my bus. I'm in my fortress.
Where is
for the zombie apocalypse.
Where is that so that I can know where to go?
Where to go? It's in San Francisco, on one of the seedier streets of San Francisco, actually, 6th Street.
Even better. Seedier, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Do you keep getting tickets from cops that are trying to get you to move your bus?
No, I have a fort now. They have to come up to the fence on my fort and write a parking ticket for it, which would be super weird. I think I could fight that one in court.
Oh, man.
How long have you had that bus, Dave?
I got the bus almost 10 years ago, but I moved into it actually right around the time I opened the rent party, which was 2009. So I've been using the bus as my kind of San Francisco or my West Coast home base for about 4 years.
So I wanted to ask, originally I thought your bus was supposed to be like a blues party bus and you were going to put a second deck on it and have dancing or something. Was that?
You have a vivid imagination and,
Do
and
I?
Selective memory of discussions we've had about the bus. I actually have had a blues party on the bus. I had Sean Morse and somebody else on guitar and somebody singing, playing in my kitchen area while I had about 30 dancers in here because I was up at was it Emerald City? I was up at a Seattle blues event. Do they call it Emerald City still?
It was Emerald City. Yeah, but it was
Rain
probably
City.
Emerald City.
It was still Emerald City then, and they had this weird idea that it was okay to have an hour and a half break between your evening dance and your late night. So I just told people, hey, I'm going to just park my bus in front of the late night, and we're going to have a party there until they open the door. So
that's awesome.
It was a fun time.
Wait, did you have like all the stuff that you have, like the refrigerator and the actual kitchen and the bed and everything set up in the bus, and you had 30 dancers in there?
Yeah, but the bed folds up against the wall, so it's all open space.
Okay.
And the whole computer desk folds into the wall as well.
Yeah, because I was wondering how that worked.
It's a transformer.
More than meets the eye.
Oh no,
that's
no.
Nice.
Don't do it, Elena.
Okay, no. So we're gonna cancel that from the record as well.
Strike it from the record.
Yeah, so I mean the bus has always had the reason I got the bus was because I wanted space, but I wanted to stop paying rent in San Francisco, but I still wanted to be able to be in San Francisco. So but the bus is fairly open because I like having open space, regardless of whether I'm going to add a secondary deck or other such things.
Do you still take it to Burning Man?
Oh, yeah. Pretty much anywhere that I'm on the West Coast, the bus comes with. I'm going to the hot springs. There's some hot springs about 3 hours outside of San Francisco next weekend, if anybody wants to come with.
Is that an invitation to everybody, all of the listeners?
Yeah, if you get this podcast, whenever this podcast is published, or whenever people listen to it, next week I'll be at a hot springs, and they can come with.
Andy, make sure you publish this in time so that people can
make it out
to those hot springs.
You're That's probably awesome. Going to get at least one email about this, Dave. You know
That's actually,
after the fact.
Depending on the email, that could be very fine with me. Okay, let's talk about safety and dance movies now.
We're good at segues like that.
That's awesome. That's an awesome segue. And actually, Dave, can you share with us a little bit about your personal dance history?
Oh, yeah. So I started with Lindy Hop. I was a total non-dancer. I had no, dancing or rhythm or anything. I think I danced, three times in my life until, what year was that, 1996. I saw swing dancing for the first time in the very cheesy and seminal movie Swing Kids, which I adore because it changed my life. And I very clearly remember the opening scene where they show people, where they're walking into the Bismarck, and there's all these people swing dancing, which I had just never seen before. And when I saw that, I was like, that's what I'm doing with the rest of my life. And that was November 8th of 96. And then and I started dancing pretty much nonstop with Lindy. And then blues started coming into the scene around 99, mostly 2000. And in 2001, I was a little resistant to it at first because I was like, I'm a Lindy guy. That's my thing. Right, around 2000 or so, blues started appearing at Lindy late nights, like especially at exchanges. And I finally had my first dance thanks to Melissa Variano, who's one of my favorite follows, who forced me to.
Oh, yeah.
From San Diego, now in Minnesota. Right. She she said, God damn it, you're going to dance with me to this song, and forced me to have a blues dance in November of 2001 at the Austin Lindy Exchange Sunday late night.
Ooh.
And totally changed my life. So.
Mel, from down here, helped put on some of our big events down here in San Diego, so I can see where she would get folks to dance and do fun things.
Yeah, I used to actually, I mean, she was a good friend of mine, and I used to come down to San Diego all the time because Southwest had such cheap deals. I used to come down every couple months and help her run whatever she was running and get in for free and just dance in San Diego. San Diego used to be like my second dance home.
Aww. So, right. True. That's awesome. True.
Yeah. Were you down here for some of the rhythmic arts stuff then?
I went to rhythmic arts a little bit. I was a little torn about rhythmic arts because of in fact, that's part of my personal history with competition and blues. Back when I was still trying to sort out competitions and make them right, as opposed to just now where I'd happily remove all of them from the dance scene. But that's maybe more of the opinionated Dave than we need to get into. Those are stressful.
It is on the list of questions.
Yeah, totally
that's
is.
One of my
Fuck
questions.
Competitions. Get let's talk it. About that. Blow
yeah,
them all
let's
up.
Do it. Hey, Dave, how do you feel about competitions?
Bam.
They're bullshit.
Oh, this should
no,
be
I think
good
here's
discussion.
What I think. I think we are part of a. To me, what's interesting about dancing is that it's a social dance, and I think performance and competition in particular, I think has a negative effect on the dance, and I think that negative effect is stronger than any. You know, I mean, you can come up with a little positive, you know, bonuses of performance competition about inspiration and things like that, but I think the negative effects are so much bigger than the positive effects.
What
that I at my at this point I would happily yeah. just delete competitions entirely from dancing.
What do you think the negative effects are?
Yeah.
I'll give you a specific example. I went to the Grenoble Lindy Exchange and they had competitions there, which I didn't really know because I just like whatever, I'm going to be in near France and they're having an exchange, so I'll go check it out. And I have all these people I wanted to see, and I show up and I was really excited to see these people, but then the competition started and everything changed, and suddenly like it was palpable how different the attitude was, because suddenly all these great dancers who I wanted to hang out with and dance with were suddenly like really concerned about who they were dancing with, because they like there was a Jack and Jill and they wanted to make sure they danced with the other people they thought they were going to be finalists. And then like when they had the finals or they chose the finalists and the people who weren't in were suddenly angry and pissed off that they didn't get in, and the other people wouldn't dance with them because they needed to dance with other people. And it was really like, I mean, look, the thing is this, you I'm a very competitive person, but I like to compete in arenas that are objective, right? Like you whip out a Monopoly board and I will destroy you. I will destroy you until you're crying, right? Because Monopoly has a clear understanding of who wins and who loses. But when you're talking about an art form, you know, there's no proper way to judge like who's better or who's worse. And so when you start doing that, all you're going to do is make people unhappy. It's not like, show me the competition where, you know, you had 15 people compete in a Jack and Jill, and afterwards they announced the winners, and all the 14 other people said, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, they were the best. We're good. Everything's fine, and I'm fourth place, and that made sense. Like, that's never going to happen.
I don't know. I kind of disagree on that, actually.
Hey,
I mean,
who's
I think
being
there's
your
a.
Pal?
Hey, well, that's fine. We can disagree.
Andy has a four. All right.
I think there needs to be exchanges where the focus is competition.
Well, wait a second.
There
I don't
be
have
another.
A problem with weekend. First of all, it wouldn't be an exchange. By definition of what an exchange is, it's not a competition weekend. But I mean, yeah, if I know there are events that are competition weekends. I get that. I mean, like Blue Shadows. a fine example of plenty of competitions at a blues event, but what is the gain from that? I mean, like, and what's odd even further is that that's used to determine who can teach, which to me is weird because you're looking at three different skill sets. You're looking at the social dancing as a skill set, you're looking at, like, performance choreography as a skill set, and then you're looking at teaching as a skill set. And the one that seems the least linked to the other two is performance choreography, unless you want to teach your students how to perform and choreograph and, you know, and look good in front of an audience. But I think most people go to these weekend workshops to learn how to become better social dancers. So why are we picking our teachers from those that show off the best? Who cares?
That's a valid point to consider in terms of who do we learn from? I mean, do we learn from folks that perform well if we wanted to be a better social dancer? I know when I started dancing, I just simply wanted to be more comfortable in my dance. And so I can see your point about three different skill sets. Within the scope of dance, then, what would you use as tools to determine how well someone teaches the dance or communicates the dance?
Oh, you know, I've had a dream of an event that I want to throw. Except the problem is if I throw it, then I can't compete in it. The competition I want to do is I want to have all the teachers show up in one place, and then you get a whole bunch of new dancers, like, who literally have never taken any classes at all. And you just give them free classes where, like, each teacher gets 10 students, and then you give them a weekend to teach the students as much as they can take, and then you judge the students dancing through actually dancing with them and pick the teacher who is most able to, you know, get the students to a high enough dance level. I would love to see that event.
That would be fun. I'd go to that.
Good. Organize it. I want to go to it.
Well, we can talk about that later.
Someone who sure. hears this podcast, please steal my event. But if you don't fucking tell me about it, I will kick your ass. Oh, wait. Do I have to watch my language? Is this like Comedy Central?
No.
We censor all material. If you didn't know,
tell me
we
about
censor.
It.
Yeah.
Beep, beep. If you don't beep, beep, tell me about it, I will beep your beep, and then you will beep.
The next 2 minutes are rated R rating on this.
Yeah.
And you'll add a warning. It's okay.
So, I mean, I think teachers should be judged based on how they teach, on their students, on what the students learn, how much the students enjoy the classes, and how good of a dancer they become, how much they're affected by it. And even then, it's, again, like, we have this basic problem that you're talking about in an art form, so it's really hard to determine, like, what is better. And I think just competitions are about watching people dance and determining who's better, and there's something kind of ridiculous about that. The last competition I ran was actually at Blues Rising, we did a Jack and Jill where we, and by the way, I don't recommend this because it was an administrative nightmare, but we blindfolded all the follows and had them dance with leads they didn't know and had them judge their leads, and then we blindfolded all the leads and did the reverse, which I think was fascinating to do, but oh my God, it was such an administrative nightmare.
Why is that?
It is. Tracking.
It was so much more complicated in the end to try to deal with all the numbers and get the answers from people. Try it. See what happens.
Like speed dating, right?
It was a nightmare.
You would do it in a speed dating manner and just have them by numbers, right?
I know, but you're going around to people who are blindfolded and telling them that they have to give you a number from like 1 to 5 or whatever for judging their partner. But you have to make sure that the partner can't hear. And then, believe it or not, you can tell every single person with a loud microphone, hey, figure out now what that number is. And then when you go to each person, they have to like really make it look like they're thinking about it. So one, it takes forever. And then you have to get all these numbers and make sure they're in order, because if one number's out of order, then all the results are invalid.
Ouch.
That's a lot of
Well, whatever. I mean, if you want to run such an event, hire me, and I will not run it for you, but I will tell you how to run it so it doesn't go totally haywire.
Nice.
So I had kind of two questions. The first one was, I know, because when I was in Iraq, I spent hours reading your blog because I was bored. And
I have a blog?
Yeah, he has all. He has like 18 million websites.
I guess if you concatenate them all together, awesome. That wow. constitutes a blog.
I guess. I don't know.
I actually have an actual blog, though.
I was reading your it's stories that you tell about your life, and I was reading about the first Lindy Exchange in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And how Lindy Exchanges actually came into being. I know it's not blues, but blues has exchanges now, too, because of that one weekend, the weekend.
I think blues is the existence of the contemporary blues scene owes a lot to that weekend in a historical sense. I mean, should we just segue into like where my vision of the history of our current blues scene?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, okay, so the very first exchange did not have blues at it, but it certainly was like a seed of what was to come. And that was actually on my birthday, thank you very much, coincidentally.
Wait, your dance birthday or your actual
my
biological birthday?
My geological birthday.
Okay.
My mom's vagina birthday. You might want to start that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God.
You should have seen my face. I will never think of biological birthdays the same again.
This is why I love you so much.
My face was like, what?
Well, that was when that happened. And it didn't happen afterwards, thank goodness. So. This has become a whole new interview. Oh, my goodness. What questions can we ask them about blues that will get them to talk about their mom's vagina? So, safety in the dance seat. I'm sorry.
Wow.
What were we talking about?
Totally lost track of it. Yeah.
The first Lindy exchange happened in San Francisco. It happened to be on my birthday, only coincidentally. But it was because a bunch of Chicagoans came out to San Francisco. But, I mean, that's like Lindy Hop history. So what became interesting is that because exchanges were just about social dancing and because you didn't have classes to go to in the morning, the dances went really late, like 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. You know, like you'd have dancing from 8 until 7 in the morning or 9 until 7 in the morning. And consequently, the music would start to slow down around 3 or 4 because people would get tired. Like, look, go to a Balboa event and you show me that they're dancing after 2 in the morning and I'll be completely surprised because Balboa dancers don't party. We all know that, right?
Yeah, we know now if we didn't
I've
know
never
before.
Gone. No, I have no idea.
Look, hey, you go to Babel. Babel has blues, Lindy, and Bal. The Bal ends at midnight or 1. The Lindy ends at like 1 or 2, and then the blues goes all night. That's how it works. Blues dancers know how to party.
Yes,
it's true.
I don't know. I went to Frankie 95 and stayed up till the sun with you guys.
Okay.
Well,
so Lindy Hopper's not a
party
blues too.
Lindy Hopper's party too, but between the blues dancers will always out-party Lindy Hopper's.
That's true.
And I'm both, so it's confusing because sometimes I out-party myself.
You've got an identity crisis happening.
So then who wins?
Yeah. I always win, Elena. I can't believe you don't know that by now.
Yeah, that's true. I should know that by now.
Okay, so, but the point is that, like, the music would get slower and slower, and it started, I mean, like, the dancing eventually has to transform, right? Because if the music changes, if we're being musical, the dancing changes. So late night at Lindy Exchange just started turning into more and more blues music or slow dancing or whatever. And a couple Lindy events, like San Francisco and Austin and a few, I can't remember if Chicago did this or not, but a lot of the bigger Lindy exchanges started having separate rooms for the slower music to play in. Although it wasn't probably being called blues at the time, but a lot of blues music was being played. And a lot of quasi-blues music. And I don't mean that in the sense of fusion. I mean, like, stuff that actually is reasonably close to blues. You can leave that one in. You don't have to strike that
from the
record.
I figured you'd be okay with that one, yeah. All
right. Yeah. In fact, actually, the first blues song I ever danced to, and I say blues, I just did my quotes thing with my fingers, was actually Alicia Keys' Falling. And it's not really a blues song.
Interesting.
But,
it's blues.
So what happened is, like, people were experimenting a lot with slow dancing, and the dance started kind of slow. It was beginning to converge on something. That was, to me, like the first phase of blues dancing. It was something that was attached to another dance's event. And the second stage was with, in my opinion, house parties. And I think there are probably some who, people in the vintage world would disagree with that, although I will say that the house parties started before their vintage events did. So, ha-ha. So, neener. But there were, basically, there was this idea of taking this thing that was happening at a late-night Lindy event, which I still don't think we were actually even calling blues yet, and having a party that was just based around that. And that started with Lindy Booty in San Francisco, which was at the apartment I had on Fulton Street back in San Francisco, as well as I understand it, up in Canada, there was Alka Holidays with Jeff and Ma, which I don't know much about, but I know it was around that same era, and as I understand it, it was the same kind of thing, although evidently maybe a little more alcohol-based. So, but Lindy Booty became kind of a phenomenon. It originally started as just the idea of, like, hey, let's invite these dancers who do these late night things, which had a fairly high caliber of dancing, right? Because you're talking about people who are traveling regularly to Lindy exchanges and staying up all night, right? So these are people who had been social dancing for a while. And let's just kind of all meet together and do this dance that we're doing to slow music. And what was interesting is that people traveled from all up and down the West Coast initially, and even from all around the country eventually, to come to Lindy Booty, and then they'd go back and have parties, you know, back in their own city. We had a lot of that in Seattle and Portland, because we'd have people coming down in these huge carpools from Seattle and Portland for Lindy Booty 1 month, and then like next month they'd have a house party in Portland or in Seattle, and we'd get in a bunch of cars and go from San Francisco and go up there. So there was like this exchange that was happening during the house party era, which was wild and fun, but it was like only the second phase, in my opinion, because like it didn't have any way to bring in new people. It didn't have any way to teach. There was no formalization of the dance. And around this time, there was the beginnings of, maybe you could call it the vintage scene, but again, vintage would be in quotes for reasons that would lead to a huge argument if Damon and I were having this conversation simultaneously. But right. This is my interview, so... but I mean, they were like Cheap Thrills started at that time. I mean, I will say this, there were a lot more of us than of them. So, you know, we win at this point. But what happened is there was the third phase started with kind of what was almost the last Lindy Booty, or at least the last important Lindy Booty, in my opinion. So in 2004, we had Lindy Booty, each time, we just kept getting bigger and bigger because more and more people were traveling to it, and that made us kind of want to up the ante. So in 2004, we decided to hold, like, this three-day-long house party that we had, like, multiple bands. I don't know, it was, like, four or five bands at, and we had three different dance floors. We cleared all the furniture out of my house and put down plywood, so there were, like, even the carpeted areas were danceable. The kitchen had a sound system in it. I mean, it was like this huge event that we did. We brought in somewhere between 300 and 500 people. And what happened is Mihai, who most people know from Friday Night Blues, Mihai came to me and said, "Listen, you want people to come and DJ for you. Let's bring in Jerry and of Jerry and Kathy, and let's bring in Kelly and Dr. Feelgood, Stephen Watkins, and Solomon." He said, "I'll bring them in and have them teach workshops, and then you can use them for DJing, you know. And can you just advertise the fact that we have workshops?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds great." And in fact, I gotta admit, I'm like he noticed something that we were failing to do, which was to bring in new people, to kind of try to turn this into like a, let's teach people how to do that so it's less exclusive, which is surprising to me because I'm generally very inclusive in, I mean, as much as I dislike people, I'm very inclusive when it comes to the dance. I believe, like, I don't believe in like private events where, like, you know, you don't invite everybody. And with Lindy Booty, I made very, you know, that was an argument I had with the other people who were helping me run Lindy Booty, which, by the way, a shout out to Dima Kumitz, who was one of the main people originally behind Lindy Booty, and Kermit Goodman, who also helped me run it for many years. But for me, it was important that we were always, like, inclusive, but I had never thought about, like, oh, how do we bring in new dancers to this thing? And Mihai came up with this idea. Not that there weren't other people doing workshops and teaching, but I think when we combine it with Lindy Booty, that got a whole bunch of new people who had never even touched on the dance. And what happened is, you know, Lindy Booty historically pretty much lost money, but his workshop was pretty successful, I guess, made him some money. And he ended up starting this thing called Friday Night Blues Practica in a very small studio in San Francisco, and it was a weekly practica that would have like maybe 12 people show up at it for the first 6 months, and we'd throw like a few dollars into a basket, and it was very loosely run, which I think was great. And basically we'd dance, and then maybe somebody would lead either a class or a question session, or would ask like, "Hey, can anybody teach me this?" And then everybody would have input about it. And what happened is you have those people who showed up regularly to the blues practica kind of finally started to understand the dance they were doing and became proficient at it and comfortable enough to ask their friend, like to have their friends come. And they had been going enough times that their friends were like, "Where are you going every Friday night?" So something happened. And I tell this story when I go teach, because I teach a lot in Europe where they're like, "We want to start a blues scene." And I think this is like an important element of it. It's like you get people who are doing it regularly enough that their friends are like, what is this thing you're doing? And then they feel comfortable enough to say, hey, come do this with me. And Friday Night Blues literally exploded. Like for the first 6 months, it was like 12 or 14 people showing up. And then suddenly it was 150 people. It was almost overnight. It was like maybe I feel like it was happened all in like the span of a month. And Friday Night Blues became the first real weekly venue. Wow. This is the oldest running weekly blues venue. And in fact, things like Wade's up in Seattle was originally started and modeled after what was happening at Friday Night Blues.
Which is no longer at Wade's anymore because of, I don't know what.
Yeah, what do they call it now? Do they call it like X-Wade's or something?
No, so it was officially, I think the name was Burn Blue, but I've recently learned that Burn Blue is the organization name, but it's at Velocity Dance Club, and it's now Blues on the Beat every Tuesday in Seattle. Yeah.
Shouldn't it be Blues a little bit on and after the beat?
Nice.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Like, blues lag.
My question was, is that the venue scene, did that start up in the West Coast or the East Coast? I actually don't know.
In our contemporary scene, the oldest weekly blues venue is in San Francisco, and it's Friday Night Blues. Because when Friday Night Blues became successful, we stopped running Lenny Booty because I don't believe in conflicting with venues. And to me, having a weekly venue may not be as fun as a house party, but having a weekly venue means new dancers, means growing the scene. To me, a weekly venue is a much better thing than having a house party every month or two. So once Friday Night Blues became successful, we stopped doing Lenny Booty pretty much completely. I think we ran like two more after that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, because there's a Friday Night Blues.
The Friday Night Blues that's in New York was started by Mihai after he left San Francisco and started there. And in fact, the New York blues scene, in a sense, the second phase of that was actually started by Jeremy Lightsmith because he actually used to live out in New York in a warehouse. He came to a Lenny Booty because he was traveling quite a bit and brought it back to New York. Like, he started the house party blues scene in New York after coming to a Lenny Booty. And furthermore, God damn it, Stephen Watkins moved to San Francisco because of Lenny Booty. You can ask him that one. He said he came out here because of Lenny Booty, and he's like, damn, I'm staying here.
We'll definitely have to bring that back around when we have a chance to talk to him. That's awesome.
That would be
good. Ask him why he moved to San Francisco.
Damn.
I have another question. Why do you teach? Why do you dance? Why do you travel to dance? Those are three questions.
Why do I travel to dance? That's kind of a stupid question, isn't it? Dave, we don't understand. People are willing to fly you all around the world to do this thing you love. Why do you do it? Teaching? I mean, you know, there's a bunch of reasons. I mean, like, one is, like, is because of what I said. Like, people are going to fly me around the world to do this thing involved with what I love. But also there's like kind of the joy of spreading this thing that I love, this like being able to create more dancing and more dance scenes. But there's also like there's a joy that comes from teaching which captures some people and doesn't capture others. Like I have some other dancer friends who I love their dancing, but they never teach and they're just not even interested in it. So it's a different skill set. Like, and to me it's something that's fascinating and fun to do. And it's entertaining. Like I really enjoy and get a kick out of going and teaching a class and seeing how they learn and experiencing that.
Cool.
Plus there's the entertainment side of it from the other perspective. Like I enjoy, you know, doing it from the entertainment perspective because if you don't entertain your class, they're not going to learn anything. They're going to check out and they're going to be gone. So to me, teaching is about first figuring out like what is it that this dance is about and then figuring out like what is it that they're missing that's a part of, you know, what this dance is about, and then figuring out how to transfer that knowledge to them, and then getting to do this experience of, like, trying it and seeing what works and what doesn't. I mean, I think it's a fascinating puzzle. It really drives me.
Yeah.
Not so, as much as dancing does, though. So for me, like, I am careful. I specifically have a rule that I don't teach more than half the weekends of the year. Because that...
Okay.
Because
so
if,
why do you have
if
that
you,
rule?
If you look at any of... I can only think of one teacher who teaches full-time, as in, like, every week of – pretty much every week of the year, 50 weeks or so of the year, and still regularly dances socially. And that's my teaching partner in Europe. That's Ursi. She's the only one I know of that teaches every week and still wants to go social dancing. Because when you teach, it's like when I started teaching big workshop weekends, you know, I'd go and I'd teach, you know, you teach, like, all day long. And then I don't condone teachers not going out dancing in the evenings when they're teaching a weekend workshop, but I understand it. I mean, I think it's important that we go out and we go dancing, but it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Teaching takes energy out of you in so much more than taking classes.
Well, because as a teacher, you're not only like presenting material, but you have to guide people's focus, and you have to make sure that they stay on track. You have to make sure they're entertained. You have to make sure that they're actually getting what you're saying. And you have to do everything right.
And the energy level,
as a student,
level too.
You can totally check out for even a moment or for 20 seconds in a class. As a teacher, you can't check out at all during your class. And to me, like, students take energy in from the teacher if the teacher's doing a good job. But, like, teachers have to, like, give energy to everyone in the room continuously. So, like, when we're done teaching, if we go teaching all day, like, literally, I just have to go somewhere quiet and sit down, which is not a usual state for me to be in. After I teach all day, I need to just go somewhere quiet and just stay there for a little while and then get some food, because I know I'm going out dancing that night and I have to recharge, because it's brutal. It's exhausting.
So, Dave, while on that topic of teaching, what's your experience been like teaching and dancing overseas compared to here in the States? What have you found to be similar or different?
Well, Europe is, I do most of my overseas teaching in Europe, and I love it just because I'm kind of a Europophile. I love being in Europe. I love the attitudes there. But the blues scene, when I first started teaching there, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, or seven. I'm not sure. I could look that up. Wait, are we supposed to be recording? I'm just kidding.
Nice. Nice one.
2008.
We'll just have more talks with you, Dave.
So I used to, actually, well, my very first blues teaching job ever was actually in Harang in 2003 or something like that. But I mean, so I taught blues at Harang. God, I've been doing that for like a decade now. But that's like the evening drop-in classes. And that's just one of the things that I do. But the actual workshops in Europe started in 2008 when, because I'd been dancing with Ursi for a while, Ursula from Switzerland, and we love dancing. She's, in my opinion, she is the best follow in the world, period. Lindy Hop or blues, she's absolutely the best follow in the world. And I love dancing with her, and we talked a lot about teaching together for years. And then finally, she actually sent me a message saying, that's not going to happen unless we're on the same continent, so you have to come to Europe. And I was like, oh, that's a good point. So I went out there in 2008, and since then, I've been spending about half the year in Europe teaching, and I do some teaching in the States, although I find I do less and less just because, first of all, I don't have a teaching partner here right now since Haley stopped teaching, who just had a baby, by the way.
Oh, very nice.
One of my favorite people in the world, but not really teaching anymore. And also, like, teaching in San Francisco I should do it more, but it's hard to justify when I, you know, can instead be paid much more and flown to another country to do the same thing. So,
right.
So I become lazy. Anyway, so teaching in Europe is, the level is generally lower, and they're much more interested in learning everything about the dance, which I find kind of fascinating. There's something I love about that, because what I really enjoy most of all is being able to go somewhere and be, I mean, there's something great about doing like the big weekend workshops. They have those in Europe as well, you know, and like I just did one of the Mile High Blues recently, and that's fun. But really what you end up doing is you get each of the levels for like one or two classes, and so you kind of give them like some really interesting, fun, like dense, powerful material that will hopefully hook them, in my opinion, so that you can actually go out to wherever their scene is and teach a weekend workshop by yourself, because then you get the students for the whole weekend, and you get to go from like from the beginning of blues all the way up to what you think is like the more advanced material. So what I love about Europe is that I get to go there and start with foundations, and I don't have to like argue with the organizers about how everybody needs a foundations class, right? Because they're like absolutely, and I get to kind of, it's kind of like I get to go there and download everything I know about blues, or like the significant portions of it, you know, like if I can manage to get like, you know, a 3-day workshop or a 2-day, like 5 hours a day, I can give them like most of what I care about blues, and let them then like chew on that and sit on that after I'm gone and come back and see where they're at later on. But sometimes it's frustrating because Europeans, sorry, go ahead.
I was about to ask, what countries are you going to? Is there language barriers when you actually teach?
We've needed translators in two places, and one of them, I think, was Budapest. I think. I don't remember. It was somewhere where there were significantly there was a significant number of people who really had trouble with English. No, in Budapest they didn't understand English, but they didn't need us to translate. They'd like just sit there and pretend they understood. It took us a while to figure out, like, they were asking. Like, there was a lot of talking going on in class, which is sometimes because, you know, the students are just unruly, and here it was because they're like, wait, what is everything he said but in my language? I don't remember where it was. We had one place where they needed a translator, and then also we were in France, in Toulouse, and they requested a translator, and we'd keep trying to say things like, I'd say something short, like, try it again, go, and something that we'd hear this, there was this one guy who kept saying, oh, traduise, s'il vous plaît, you know, and the translator, it slowed the class down so much. It was very frustrating, and at the end of the weekend, this guy who kept asking for us to translate over and over came up to me, and he said, oh, your class was very interesting, I really like the things you took, like, his English was perfect, he had no problem understanding us in English, he just really wanted to hear it in French.
Wow.
So there's some French bashing.
As a follow-up question, your website says that you've been helping the European blues dancing scene develop. What's that experience been like, and do you find that there are significant differences in developing scenes here?
The biggest
difference
is overseas.
That
there's the European attitude. There's a very big difference between European and kind of the American or North American attitude about being ready to teach something. Well, let me put it this way. Like, in America, you know, you go to a scene and you teach blues, and then whoever's like the most well-known or the most prepared will be like, okay, I'm going to start teaching blues every week. Let's go, right? But in Europe, the question we always get is like, where can we go blues dancing? And I said, you know, and I tell them, start a venue. I tell them the Friday Night Blues story. I'm like, start a venue and start dancing. And their question is always, yeah, but we have no one to teach at it. And I'm like, you can teach at it. I give you permission. You won't do a great job, and that's fine. Because what will happen is either you'll learn how to do a good job or somebody else will. Just have people teaching, and you'll figure out who the good teachers are, and you'll move forward. But it's really tricky. Like, Europe has a really hard time. There's kind of this audacious nature or arrogance that, you know, that we have in North America, where people are more than willing to teach before they're ready. I don't know if you've ever heard that joke, like, how do you know when you're ready to start teaching? And the answer is, don't worry, you'll be teaching long before then, right? So
I had not heard that.
I've never heard
that
either.
It's very true.
And yeah. In Europe, they have a real problem with that. So one of our struggles is really, and in fact, one of the things I'm actually adding to my curriculum now when I'm doing weekend workshops in Europe is how to start a scene, to actually do more than just give them a coaching, but like start working on getting them to teaching before they're ready, because that's the only way you'll get them to actually have the weekly venue. And that's what they need.
So they're actually reluctant to even take a risk and start teaching because they don't think they're qualified, or they just don't think they have enough knowledge about the dance, the culture?
Well, it's just not culturally, it's not how they work. Like, they're like, well, how could I teach that? I don't know that. I have to be an expert at that before I teach it, you know?
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
If I'm like, hey, can you start teaching some astrophysics? And you'd be like, I don't know astrophysics.
I'd need a PhD in astrophysics. And I get that because I'm more on the cautious side as well. I feel like you'd have to have certain experience.
Well,
that's why I think the model at Friday Night Blues was so fantastic, because it was open to whoever wanted to try to teach in the early days of Friday Night Blues. Would be like, yeah, go ahead and try to teach a class. And if you crash and burn, then you wouldn't come back. If you did okay, then you could come back and teach some more and more. And it became not just a place for people to learn how to dance, but like the early days of Friday Night Blues was a breeding ground for teachers, which is why, you know, at least a few years ago, so many of the best teachers came out of either San Francisco or, you know, Seattle, where Wade's did the same kind of thing, right? So many of the great teachers came out of that.
Do you think that venues or events are less likely to do it in general because they're now adopting that same approach of you have to have X amount of experience prior to teaching? And is that why you don't see that anymore?
I think most venues in general, whoever's running the venue, is either teaching or having someone that is their friend teaching. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think Mihai is a controversial character, but I give a lot of credit to him for the fact that he left it open and he let, you know, anybody try to teach. And there were some bad teaching experiences, but I think the net positive was huge.
Wow. And I think that's a good segue for our next questions I had, Dave. And speaking of bad teaching experiences, one of our previous interviews, someone had talked about teaching on the dance floor as probably one of the worst forms of unsolicited feedback. What's your thoughts on?
Yeah, I think
that was
Nicole, right? Talking about how it was an issue of consent, which I totally agree with. I I thought that was a really nice way of putting it. It's like, you know, I did not consent to having you give me feedback. I think unsolicited feedback is, I just have a general rule against it because I'm big on universal rules. And to me, like unsolicited feedback, it just doesn't happen. And I would go further than, I think Nicole was saying, you know, like, it's an issue of consent, you know, like, so if you give someone unsolicited feedback, they didn't necessarily consent to hear that. So you should ask them if they want it. But it's not like, I would go further than that because I think, you know, like, could you imagine you're like dancing with someone and like, hey, do you want some feedback on how that dance was? And you're like, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, I don't have any. Okay, bye. Like, I'm clearly like, or hey, it was really great. See you later. Like, clearly they have some feedback. And I would say, like, you know, unless someone is asking me for feedback, I would never do that because that's like me imparting judgment on their dance, which I just don't think is right. But what's funny, like, I will say this in addition, like, I don't have a problem with somebody saying, hey, what do you think I should work on or whatever, but you need to tell me before we start dancing because I'm not in judgment mode. I think it's a common misconception that I get, like, people tell me, people treat teachers differently, which I think is odd.
Yes.
I've had this situation. I often go to, like, when I'm doing a weekend workshop, I'll show up, like, Thursday or Friday beforehand because I want to hang out in the city for a while. And I've had people who dance with me, they've asked me to dance, and then they come up to me during the workshop. I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't know you're the teacher. I wouldn't have asked you to dance if I knew you were the teacher. I'm like, that's terrible. Like, why am I being punished for being the teacher? Like, I'm not allowed to dance with people. But people tell me, like, they're, like, really intimidated dancing with a teacher because they feel like they're being judged. And I would say, you should feel the least intimidated to dance with a teacher because it's probably going to turn out okay. You should be scared of dancing with beginners. You know, like, I mean, I think you should do that too. I think everybody should dance with everybody, but like, why are you scared of dancing with someone who's going to make sure everything's fine? But when I am dancing with people, I am not judging everything they're doing wrong. So like, when somebody says like, you know, oh, what do you think I should work on? I'm like, well, now we need to dance again because I wasn't like looking at you as a teacher. I was just social dancing.
Right, well, and I think, sorry, go ahead, Alina.
Oh, I was just going to say, I remember when I started blues dancing, and I think I asked you for feedback, and you were like, I don't teach on the social floor because I'm here to social dance, and it devalues my, you know, it devalues my instruction, because you get paid for that. I mean,
that sounds like something, honestly, somebody else would have said, because, no, seriously, I've heard other people say that, and I know a lot, like, Ursi says that as well. I don't want to take a I don't want to walk aside and spend a whole long time teaching, but I wouldn't have a problem if you asked me before we start dancing to give you like feedback on what I think you should work on. I could do. But
Dave, would you consider that possibly maybe one more side effect of having so many like a competition mindset where people, especially because a lot of teachers also compete, and maybe they just feel like there's that added sense of trying to impress a teacher that you've either seen instruct or seen compete when you dance with them socially. I'm not saying that's true of every instructor.
I'll flip it. I kind of would say it a different way. I feel like competition is part of this. Is just all part of the clickiness of dancing that I think we can avoid. You know, like looking at levels, looking at like who's better than who. This all kind of creates this hierarchy of like, oh, you can't ask them to dance because they're X better than, they're two levels better than you, and that's rude. I mean, it's like we're all there to social dance. We all started as a beginner. I'm not a socialist in the real world, but when it comes to dancing, like, I feel like we should all dance. I have a strong opinion about how we should all. In fact, that's an interesting thing we should talk about. This new trend of like empowering people saying no to dance requests.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, what
I think
that way.
I think people should definitely be empowered to say no, but I think that should be that when you're teaching people that, you should be saying, you know, but you. We should be letting people know that they should generally say yes to dance requests, because I've seen scenes where, like, oh my God, when you like all the best dancers are like, you know, they say no to everybody except the other best dancers, and they're always in one corner. I remember, in fact, I had an experience at Rhythmic Arts where all of the hot shot dancers were all in one corner and they were dancing with each other and they were turning other people down, and I wanted to put a little rope around them saying don't feed the rock stars. I was trying to get a bunch of people to go up and ask them to dance, because I saw my friends going up and asking them to dance, because like, wow, that person's a great dancer, and they go up and say, do you want to dance? I'm like, no, and they'd come back crushed, And I was like, let's do this. Let's get like 40 people to go up and ask one person to dance one at a time, like every 5 seconds, you know, until they like feel so uncomfortable that they have to leave the venue. Because why are you there if you're not dancing with people? Right. But that's not to say like that you have to dance with people. Like very clearly, I'm not saying everybody has to say yes to every dance request. If you're not comfortable, if you don't feel safe, obviously you can say no. But I mean, as a lead, I think generally, since you the lead generally has control over the space in the dance and the safety of the dance much more than the follow does, I don't see any reason why a lead should say no. I've said no to one dance request in the last 17 years. And it was because it was somebody that I didn't even say no. I was just so surprised that she'd asked me that I didn't say anything. It was just, somebody okay. that had.
Can we find out who it was?
No. No, it was over. It was 16 years ago. I wish I could say that I've said yes to every single dance, but there's one that I didn't say yes to. How about that?
There we go.
But you didn't say no, right? You were just speechless.
Fair. I was really surprised. This was someone who had been. Who had not been friendly to me in a strong way and then came up and asked me to dance. And I was like, what? So I didn't ever say yes. But I mean, I don't turn down dance requests as a rule. So, and I can understand like wanting to make sure people know that they can say no to dancing, but let's make sure people know that they can say yes to dancing. And that it's good for them. Like you dance with beginners, you become a better dancer.
It's true.
And I think that's a nice combination message for that because, you know, it's when I think it's certainly in the era of being able to empower people to say no, I think you mentioned it earlier, it's not trying to create any an environment where you have to fear every dance request. It's more of like, you know, being empowered to say no when you don't feel comfortable, but not making people feel uncomfortable as the starting point. So, yeah.
I mean, by the same token, if somebody turns down a dance request for you, like, you shouldn't care. It just doesn't matter. Like, it's not some rejection of who you are as a person. People turn me down for dance requests. I'm like, you're lost. Like, I mean, why would I? That's your problem, not mine.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think everybody should have that attitude.
Definitely makes the dancing more enjoyable.
I wanted to hear about what you thought about this current dance scene, because you told us about the history of it. I kind of want to hear
you
what
kids
you think
today,
about it.
You can't dance for shit!
Okay, so...
Keep that.
I guess
keep
we'll
that.
Have more keep questions that. after the safe spaces. Let's get that out of the way then.
Okay.
Are you ready for some stress, Dave?
Really stress me out with questions.
No, we'll keep it broad. Yeah, it'll be broad. Elena, floor is yours.
Thanks. So, Dave, we've been talking about, you know, you've heard a lot of consent culture stuff, a lot of the being able to say no. And a lot of it, what it comes down to for some dancers is feeling safe. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about safe space for dancers and empowering people to feel safe and empowering organizers to create that. What do you define as a safe space for dancers?
Huh. I think that we are involved in a physical activity that has a lot of physical closeness, which people can confuse for physical intimacy. And unfortunately, either because of confusion or because, you know, bad intent, we are put into these positions where we are more vulnerable and that can be abused. I said that sentence wrong. Let me flip that around. We are put in positions that are because of this closeness, we're in these positions that are more vulnerable, and there are going to be people there who are confused about the intent of things or are going to intentionally, you know, abuse that. And so I think to some extent we have to be aware of that and careful, like, and we have to figure out ways that we can avoid those situations and remedy them. I find the discussions that are going on now kind of fascinating, because some of them I see as being very relevant to dance scene in general because of this, like, increased intimacy and physicality. But some of it, I'm like, well, I don't see why this is specific to blues dancing. This is something that we should just be doing for society in general, right? These are concepts that apply in general. So, like, I'm not sure why we're talking about them on a blues forum. We should be talking about them. I mean, maybe it's just like it's a launching board for people to talk about these things in general. But
which topics are those?
Which, yeah.
I mean, like, just the ways that we communicate with each other. I mean, like, when certain people start talking about, you know, just how we communicate with each other and things like that, I'm like, okay, but that's not specific to blues. There is something that's specific to blues, and it's the fact that we are, you know, touching another person, and we have different lines and boundaries. Although, I feel like, you know, when you're going to blues dancing, you're signing on with being okay with having, like, somebody's hand on your back, right? Mm-hmm. Although probably not on the small of your back, right? Like, that's not part of the connection, or and it's not necessary. So, you know, but, like, there's this element of what creates the foundation of the dance that I think we're all signing on for. And people get confused about that. So I think it's important for us to, like, monitor that and make sure that the people feel comfortable in this vulnerable place that we end up being in. So I think that's important, absolutely.
Can you share some of the ways, like examples, to accomplish that in terms of creating those safe spaces?
For me,
you might have,
like,
witnessed, or
one of my biggest roles. Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I'm as a teacher, every single foundations class I teach, always mm-hmm. I always teach. You know, that I try to teach them, like, the right posture and whatnot so that we don't have intimacy issues. But even so, they're going to be dancing with people who weren't in the class, right? And so I always, like, I explain, like, the leads have a lot more power here to, you know, if you're dancing with someone as a lead and they start getting kind of all creepy and, you know, whatever, you can always be like, okay, we're dancing in open position now, right? And it can become much safer for you. But follows have this, I mean, maybe this is where I can talk about the covenant, the lead follow covenant, and why it's so important. I always teach in my classes that the follows have the right to say no to the intimacy that's being created, that they have a right to be like, no, this is too close for me and we're going to dance here. And it's important that they practice that because they're put in a position where they're saying yes to everything.
I think my favorite part of the instruction that I've been in that you've taught, because I've been in that class a couple times, I think, but you always have people go into closed embrace, and then you're like, okay, leads grunt or do something creepy, and give the follows a chance.
It's usually the that's my favorite. That's my. Now you
what do you mean?
Clip,
I totally, I enjoy that when I'm social dancing. Come on, guys.
Awesome.
I now have my new starting move. Thank you.
you could blow on your follow's ear. You
can... Right?
No, ooh, no. Like, I always
I've
say
had that,
that
happen.
Joke. Don't actually. Oh. Well, I mean,
I think
look,
we have a video on
all of it.
Bad.
The YouTube video about harangue dancing is actually based on multiple true stories. That everything in that video, it's worse than you think, because the dancing at harangue used to be a grinding kind of. People didn't know what blues was at all in Europe, so the dancing at harangue was really. Oh, super creepy and gross. And there were a lot of people. That was one of the things we had to overcome when we were traveling around and teaching back in, like, 2008, 2009. We had a lot of people like, no, I don't blues dance. That's for, you know, that's disgusting. I've seen that at harangue. And we're like, okay, but that's not the dance that I love. That's not what this is about. And we used to go to, like, at harangue, people would, I had leads and follows complain to me every single week about every single thing that happened in that video. Like, everything in that video was happening multiple times. Not to the extent we do it at the video.
Right, where you, like, lick her neck or something.
But no, wait. There, people would lick.
What?
Whoa.
I'm telling you, it was fucked up and
that was
wrong.
That was quite a challenge for
we
y'all.
We just took
then,
it a step
because,
further
in terms of
by
teaching?
Licking the entire face. No, it was absolutely. Oh. It was a huge problem for years. I mean, I think now there's enough blues events in Europe that the picture of blues is now changing. Is different. And blues at harangue has changed significantly. I've been teaching for 10 years there, and every time I teach, I'm like, I'm very, very strong on the ideas of, like, what is and is not okay in terms of intimacy and whatnot on the dance floor. Because at harangue, it's more important than anywhere else. And to be clear, I love harangue. And it's like one of my favorite homes in the world. What was happening there has improved significantly, and there are blues events now in Europe, like big blues events. And so people are getting a clear idea of it, but definitely, like, the first few years we were traveling around teaching, because we were initially the only people really going around regularly teaching blues workshops in Europe, and we had a lot of resistance from a lot of people who were like, no, that's dirty, I don't do blues dancing, that's just people grinding against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So
wait, that's
still have.
That's not what
Blues convince a swing dancer.
That's only when you're dancing with me, Elena.
It's not like that. Yeah. Hey, baby. I mean, it still happens.
Don't forget the grunting.
It still happens a lot.
It does.
It happens everywhere, and you do. Yeah. So, like, one of the things I do is, as a teacher, like, I feel like I get the chance to shape the scene towards something I love and care about, and part of that is teaching people what the dance is, as opposed to grinding on each other. As a venue organizer, I have, you know, interfered with people's attempts. We had a teacher who will remain nameless, but that we didn't have teaching at our venue. Like, we were willing to have them teach at our venue if they were willing to talk to us about these issues, but I wasn't going to go. Same thing, unsolicited feedback. I wasn't going to go and say, hey, you know, what you're doing is wrong. But I wasn't going to let them in my venue unless they were going to be doing the kind of behaviors that we thought were okay in terms of the dance. And in fact, I've actually thrown people out of other venues that I wasn't running just because, you know, the kind of behavior
Ooh. Is
Can not acceptable.
Can you tell a story?
Yeah, I need to hear
about
that.
Naming names.
No, yeah, obviously.
Well, so one time I saw Elena at Friday. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No,
and she was licking people's ears. I was like, oh, get the fuck out of here.
I had to jump to reach your ear because I'm so short, dude. That's how you caught me.
I was at Friday Blues once and somebody came up to me and said, you know, it's funny because actually a lot of times at Friday Night Blues, especially when I was in San Francisco more, people thought I ran the venue because I was there all the time. But somebody came, I don't know if they thought this or not, somebody came up to me and said, oh my God, I just had this horrible dance. That person over there is totally in a blah, blah, blah. And I remember watching them and they were doing stuff that was not in the realm of blues dancing, but was more in the realm of, you know, physically imposing themselves on other people. And so I took the guy, I said, hey, I want to talk to you. And I took him outside and we had a talk. And at first he was like, no, the women love it. I'm like, no, dude, you're not going back in there if this is going to keep up. This is not what this is about. Like, you know, I pulled rank on him a little bit, right? And at first he was kind of being this defensive kind of, you know, whatever, I'm a guy, you know, is like butting horns with me. But eventually, like, he realized, like, I wasn't going to budge on this, and he changed his attitude a lot, and I didn't see that behavior anymore. I don't know what happened to him. I don't even remember what he looks like, because, you know, I don't keep track of people, but I mean, at least for the rest of that night and the next few weeks, his behavior totally changed. I mean, I think we all have the ability to do that. Instead of just complaining about, like, the people in the scene, like, actually do something when you see something happen.
That's a really hard thing to ask of people. Like, that's really hard sometimes to be like, hey.
I understand, but why don't we work on teaching ourselves how to do that, or figuring out the group dynamics that will make that more comfortable? There's someone loud and obnoxious in every scene that can do that. I'm the person who's willing to do that in San Francisco. I'm sure you can find loud and obnoxious people in every scene, right? Or get
we
together.
Just have to make sure they're not the ones doing whatever it is.
Yeah,
sure.
Would not be helpful.
Find the loud and obnoxious person who isn't doing it, right? I mean, whatever. I mean, if they're going to stop one person, use them for that, and then have somebody else go up to them and stop them. It doesn't matter. Like, and figure out ways that as a group you can approach the situation. I know it's scary, but, like, what's scarier, to, like, have to approach someone and deal with that, or to have it in the scene and just kind of lurking and not able and be powerless?
And not address it, right?
And I'm not saying, like, every single person should be able to, like, walk someone out of the venue and have that talk, but you should be able to find someone or some group of people who can do that.
Can end
oh, but
that.
You wanted that. I wanted to mention the covenant. Because there was this question raised about, because one of the things I said that actually surprised people, because I do know that, like, a lot of people use the blues floor, people who aren't necessarily maybe doing things that are creepy but are flirting a lot in a physical way on the blues floor. Like, I'm a flirt. I get that. Like, I wouldn't even pretend for one second that I'm not. But if the problem with physically flirting and kind of pushing, like, or the way I look at it, like, if you're increasing physical intimacy on the blues dance floor, I think you're making a terrible mistake, and I think you're damaging the scene and the dance, and you're abusing something, which I call the lead-follow covenant, which is that follows are trained to say yes to everything. Like, the best follows are the ones who, like, don't even have to filter through their brain. They just automatically, like, their body responds in a yes kind of way. But the problem with that is then if you abuse that, like, and you bring them in a close position, let's say uncomfortable, like, you bring them into, like, I don't, like, if you're doing a pelvis connection with them or putting your hand on their ass or something, the problem is that if you take a great follow or someone who's learning to be that kind of a great follow, initially they'll say yes to it because that's what they're trained to do. But then cognitive dissonance puts them in this kind of horrible position where they're confused because they're like they feel uncomfortable about it, but there's the part of the brain that's like, yeah, but you already said yes to it, so mm-hmm. either it's mm-hmm. partly okay or you're a bad person, right? And so then suddenly they're in this spot where they're like, oh, that's not really comfortable, but I'm not going to say anything about it now. It's too late. He's already been doing it. Da da da. And to me, that's an abuse of what you're doing is you're destroying that covenant, and that covenant is what creates grave dancing.
That really just scared me.
Yeah, I really liked what you just said. Is that something that you explicitly discuss when teaching this lead follow covenant?
I talk about it sometimes, but I think it kind of I think it's a little too confusing for new dancers. So I try to teach them just not to do it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the problem is you're also talking about something social at that point. Like it's people who like. I mean, you know, I teach them good posture so that they're not doing a pelvic grind. But, you know, if you're going to, like, brush their hair away in kind of a sexy way and look in their eyes, I'm like, yeah, everybody just, like, threw up in their mouth a little bit there, right? You know, the problem is if you're, like, if you caress their hair, you know, that's not necessarily ruining the blues connection. So, like, that's not necessarily something I have to talk about in my foundation class. But what you're doing there is you are violating their space in a way that they don't have a – they can't properly respond to without breaking the way that they follow. Look, if you want to go to a blues scene and find people that you go and have sex with back at home, that's great. Or even on the couch at the blues dance. I don't care. Okay, maybe that would be a little disturbing. But, like, but my point is don't do it on the dance floor. You should never kiss someone for the first time while dancing. Absolutely not. It's like you should never kiss someone for the first time when they're tipsy. Like, you shouldn't do that because they're not in the proper frame of mind to make that decision.
It's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I really like that.
But what about lifts? I see people do lifts, like, to new girls, and it's one of those things that I just...
That's an interesting question, because I actually think there are... If you are really leading a lift properly, you can inspire someone to lift in a way that they're not only safe, but they're doing it on their own, and they're surprised that it happens.
Yeah,
and if you can do all of that, then I don't care if they're a beginner or not. Take my lifts class.
We're not taking about
David
those
Madison,
lifts.
BluesDance.com. I do bar mitzvahs as well as Blues Weekend workshops. Please sign.
You don't do bar mitzvahs. They wouldn't have you.
I did my own bar mitzvah, but...
I want a bar mitzvah.
I'm not talking about those lifts.
I'm talking
about the ones that they lift the girls up by the waist and then they have it be wrapped around the legs around them.
No, wait a second. If you're going to ask a question about lifts and then have this assumption that there's, like, a waist hold, like, why are you holding someone's waist in blues dancing? I didn't teach that. Like, I mean, there's plenty of lifts that don't involve... There are lifts you can do in the open position with only touching their hands, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, like, there's a whole world of lifts, and some of them are appropriate and some are not. Like, if you're going to, you know, cup their pelvis with your hand and lift them in the air, like, obviously that's inappropriate. Like, if you're going to use your fingers in their nose to lift them up, that's not appropriate. Like, I think there are plenty of lifts
that'd be skillful.
That'd be amazing.
And Andy,
if you're a cheerleader, then the pelvic cupping is evidently appropriate.
Or a rugby player.
That's weird, isn't it? Or a replica.
I have that on good authority.
Yeah, Andy, I think that just a quick thought. I feel like that's dependent on the scene that you're in. So if you're in a scene where the blues aesthetic or traditional blues isn't maybe as salient, that might be occurring versus if I were to go to D.C. or San Francisco, I feel like I see a lot less of those waist aerials in certain scenes. So it might be dependent on context.
You're going to see bad technique just about everywhere, but hopefully you'll see less bad technique and less creepy bad technique in places where people are learning
teaching.
Better dance. So.
Actually, there's one that I always need to ask, which is, what's your favorite song to dance to? Because I always put it in the beginning and end of
this podcast. Because you're
awesome. Nina Simone, Feeling Good. Although I got to say, actually, that's I'm all,
currently.
That has historically been my favorite. Yeah. I've also got Katie Webster, Pussycat Moan. It's between those two.
Okay.
Katie Webster is a genius. But I mean, anything by Nina Simone is perfect.
I'll get a fusion version where they mix both of them together.
I will kick your ass.
Ouch. Do it, Andy.
I knew he was going to throw that out.
Okay, actually, totally do it.
Yeah.
And then Dave's going to come find you when you're in San Francisco next week.
Yeah, seriously.
No, I will drive. I will come here now.
So, speaking of fusion.
Oh, wait.
Really?
Are we speaking of fusion?
Really?
Tell me what fusion is before we talk
about
it.
Please, not this discussion.
I don't know. You tell me what fusion is.
No.
No.
Fusion.
Look what's in that box over there.
Adamantly. Squirrel. Cookie. I'm just going to...
I will say this. I wish the fusion scene would stop abusing definitions and just simply saying, oh, but language evolves. Language doesn't evolve because you're trying to market something as what it isn't, for fuck's sake. You can't change what the word exchange means. You can't change what the word blues means. If it evolves over time, fine, but you don't get to just change it yourself as a marketing choice. Exchange has a meaning in the dance world, and yes, it has other meanings. Good job confusing the issue, but the word exchange in the context of a dance weekend means something specific, and it means specifically something that doesn't have workshops, doesn't have, it's a social dance event, you know? And the word San Francisco means something. It doesn't mean Oakland. Okay, I'm being...
Okay.
The word blues means something. The word blues means something, and it means something to musicians. It means something to dancers. It means something. It has meaning. And when you go ahead and just change it for the sake of marketing, what you're doing is you're making it less easy for us to communicate with each other. You're making it more difficult to get meaning across by using words. And that makes me sad.
I think you and
you're confusing
Damon
people.
Agree on that, yes. He was
unbelievably,
about
Damon
things.
And I actually agree on a
you
few
really,
things.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
guys really do.
Yeah,
don't doubt that for a second, actually.
So, we're always amused when we end up
violent agreement, yes.
What you're saying is, in blues there are no steps, so nothing can be wrong, right?
I'm going to kick your
ass.
Oh,
no. She did just say
that. She threatened me with a good time.
Wow.
I don't get where the blues doesn't have a basic comes from. I mean, like, I hear that all the time. Blues doesn't have a basic, and where is that coming from? I guess it comes from bad teachers. That's where it comes from.
Oh, man.
That's right. If you teach blues and you're telling people blues doesn't have a basic, I am calling you a bad teacher on the record. You don't have to cut that.
I think we should lead with that somehow. We should probably lead with that.
Oh, yes. Cut that. Put it in the front, Andy.
Yeah.
It's right after.
I think we'll frame that quote when we put it on the site and say, that.
Oh my God.
By the way, just a quote.
Just take it all out of context. Just keep the, keep the rest out of there.
Context? Context.
I bet if you're teaching blues, click, you're a bad teacher.
And then play Nina Simone, and then we start the interview.
Oh, man.
I think that's an awesome Perfect. Transition. Andy's going to work some magic. And
oh, man.
I got a lot of work ahead of me.
Actually, you kind of do.
Today on our podcast, we talk to Satan worshipper Dave Madison.
I hope you're saving the bloopers, Andy. This is amazing.
It is.
Oh, no, it's okay. So, Dave, what's next for you? What's on your schedule for blues events and in the near future?
I'm going to Disneyland.
Oh, really?
No, I'm, let's see, February, I'm going to be, I believe
you
I'm teaching.
You won't go to L.A. because,
I've taught in L.A. What are you,
you
talking about?
You don't like going to L.A. because of the traffic. Thus, you won't
yeah,
go.
You can't breathe traffic. There. You know, but that's a problem with L.A., not with the L.A. blues scene. No, I'll go to
Rain City in January. You totally should.
Go where?
Rain City Blues.
What's funny is, I've thought about going to Rain City. Mm. I get a lot of people, especially when I'm in Europe, people are like, oh, when are you going to teach in my city? I'm like, I don't organize events. Go tell your organizer to hire me. You know, it's like, hey, come and teach in Dublin. I'm like, sure, but like, you want to throw the event? Like, oh, I'm not an organizer. I'm like, neither am I. Like, but February I'm going to be back in Europe, and I'm going to be doing a bunch of different events. I might actually finally make it out to Russia. I had some visa nightmares the first time I tried to go there.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see. I might be teaching. I might be bringing blues to Siberia. That's actually
true.
Wow.
What?
Siberia.
Well, it's Siberia's
awesome.
Place, and it includes actual cities that people dance in.
Like, there are real actual cities there.
There are cities there.
Are you going to bring Mr. P?
Oh, she always comes with me. Yeah.
Who is Mr. P?
My cat. My cat, who is as old as my dancing is, actually. Aww. She has traveled all over the world because I'm gone. I mean, I spend 6 months a year on the road, so I could like throw her in my storage unit with a big bag of food, but I don't think she'd do so well.
Oh, wait, you can bring pets on planes, especially like Europe? I didn't even know that.
There's no quarantine going involved, or no?
If you Google pet travel to Sweden, I think I'm one of the pages on the first link that talks about what you have to do.
How did we get on pet travel? I have no idea.
Pet travel, Mr. Peterson.
Welcome to the Pet Travel Forum. Today we're talking to Dave Madison, whose cat has traveled. It's funny, she's actually, there was an article talking about some cat, it was the most frequent flyer miles cat in the world, because this cat had gotten stuck on a plane for like a couple of weeks and had racked up 500,000 miles before they found it. And I did the math. I'm like, okay. And they just, and like, so clearly this cat has traveled more than any other cat in the world. And I'm like, I think Mr. P's at about 300,000 miles or so now. So like, I don't, and she's probably not second place. So you shouldn't make that assumption.
I can't laugh anymore.
I've broken you.
Done. I'm tapping out, guys. Is there anything else that we need to... Elena, do you want to do the wrap-up? Or?
Sure.
Bluesdance.com and bluescal.com.
Oh, yeah.
And dancecal. I love that calendar. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, since I'm not on...
Fusioncal.com, actually, believe it.
Really?
It's true.
I have to say thank you for Bluescal, because I'm not on Facebook, and that's been interesting. Shut it, Andy. it's awesome. Thank you for that resource.
Sure, yeah.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. We really had a fun time.
Yay!
Lots of fun. Thank you.
And we hope we get the chance to interview you again sometime, or maybe hang out at an exchange. And what were your websites again?
Bluesdance.com is my teaching website for blues. Bluescal.com is a blues... I have thousands of websites. Bluesdance.com and bluescal.com are most relevant.
Okay, cool. And so I hope that everyone enjoyed this show. We have a podcast, as you are hearing. We also have a map of dance locations on our website, bluesdanceworld.com. And we have quite a few articles up right now. If you like what you see, let us know on our Facebook page and like us on our Facebook page. And if you feel like you would like to be a writer, send us an email at editor@bluesdanceworld.com. Thanks for listening and have a great night.
If you teach blues, I am calling you a bad teacher on the record. You don't have to cut that.
Can we keep the vagina part in?
I'm just going to say I love vaginas.